Hello, folks. Welcome. This is Chris Jansen. This recording is being made especially for the Freedom Under Natural Law Conference, Freedom Under Natural Law number 4, Humanity Rising. I got one of my favorite, actually probably top favorite YouTube creator here, Joey Phipps. Much appreciated. Thanks for joining me today, Joey.
Thank you.
Yeah, you joined me on short notice. Joey's channel, if you haven't checked it out, folks, is Library of the Untold. There's hundreds of hours of material there, awesome music that Joey's created. He's a musician as well as a writer. I got his book, which we'll discuss a little bit today, Book of Wonderful Suffering.
I love the wear and tear on that puppy.
Yeah, it's been traveling with me everywhere. I told Joey I had a bunch of receipts shoved in there from construction jobs, you know, that I had to give to customers. But yeah, maybe you could start by just telling us a little bit about the creation of that book. What was the inspiration? How did you get pushed to do that?
Sure. I kind of started noticing early on that the more sacrifice that I put into my daily life contributed to better things tomorrow. And that led to me making the chart in the book. That's a very simple chart because it shows pleasure and sacrifice. And there's like that little cross section where it's like sacrifice now equals pleasure later and pleasure now equals sacrifice later. Unfortunately, the second way that I just mentioned there, you don't get to choose your sacrifice. But if you choose sacrifice, there it is right there. Yeah, it's on it. But if you choose your sacrifice now, the fucking pleasure finds you later. So I wanted my son to know that above all. And it's like, universal law. That's how the universe works here in this particular reality for whatever reason that happens to be that is outside of my pay grade. That's just how the universe works. Sacrifice now equals pleasure later. And you can pick your favorite words for those two, you know. But I wanted my son to know that. So I wrote it all out, and then that became a book. And then I went to go print it up and just to have on the shelf for when he's old enough or if I was to die. And then there was a person there who was like, bro, he was like, we got to get this published. And he's like, I got the connections, you know? So he sent it to whoever it needed to be, which happened to be Barnes & Noble Publishing. And then they published the book, and now it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's available cheaper on Barnes & Noble, but it's less expensive. I don't know what that's about. That's outside of my control. But the book was intended for my son as kind of a Pillars of Living thing. And then afterwards, almost divine timing, very strange, because I wrote, it's called Book of Wonderful Suffering. And my wife decided to divorce me for reasons that I won't go into, but that's the oldest story in the book. Guys go through it all the time. It was horrible. The worst experience of my entire life. And it was a long process, not legally, but in the heart. It was awful. And but I was wise enough to apply my alchemical philosophy to the entire process. And it literally catapulted me into doing what I am literally right now. With my extra free time of not being married, I started a YouTube channel to talk about the book. And my son kind of co-hosted along the way, you know, kind of making the jokes for it and everything. And that took off pretty much immediately. I was flabbergasted at that. And then the book started taking off. And then as you mentioned a moment ago, I made the joke about how I'm like a failed musician. You know, I wanted to be a rock star. That was my hobby, was making music, and I wanted it to be a career. But the music industry doesn't allow for real musicians anymore that I have seen. I don't know. I don't want to get into that. But it was impossible because they have the pay to play. And you can't play live anymore as a musician without first having thousands of dollars to put down. But this fucking, again, alchemy has it. You do your work, as Jung said, you do your work, you do it honestly, and you do it alone. The others will find you. And now the albums that I've made are starting to sell as well because they're between the channel and the book and the music, they're all bouncing off of each other and everyone's finding their little favorite part of it. And I'm very happy to have been a host to all of it all along the way. You know, I read my emails. I read all of my comments. They tell you not to do that. I eat that shit up. I read all of them as much as I can now. It's starting to get out of hand. I can't keep up with it so much anymore, but I try to. But
I think every time I've made a YouTube comment, you've replied to it.
Right, right. And so, and I like to be involved down there in the trenches in the comment section. Some of the comments are not desirable, but they don't bother me one bit because as I kind of put forward first and foremost in the book and some of the videos, is that if you are doing your work honestly and you have nothing to hide and you're not trying to get one over on anybody, then you don't have to worry about the criticism. The criticism can't touch you at that point. The universe is so, reality itself is so mysterious and so strange that there is no reason to have to make up anything or stretch the truth. You talk about the Dogon tribes people and what they knew about Saturn, or to consciousness itself, DMT, all the hollow earth hypothesis, all of these things are so enormously powerful that you can just lose sleep over those all day. But people do feel the need to stretch the truth to get views. And I want to be one of the many people out there to be like, you don't have to. Just talk about the things you have learned that are real or plausibly real, and make sure that your speculation is down to earth. And it's like, dude, this shit's too easy, you know?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for not being afraid to ask questions, you know? And I think there is that fear out there. In fact, you said something about in your book, but I had a little quote on that page where you were talking about with the pleasure sacrifice chart. You said, suffering becomes art, and we can hardly think of anything great that did not come as a result of some sort of suffering.
Right.
And, you know, today's world, everybody's looking for comfort, right? And they want to be safe and comfortable. And the path towards freedom is neither of those.
Right. So if you think about the invention of literally anything, the house or the car, the toaster, all of these things were because there was some kind of suffering taking place and somebody manned up and said, I can make things better because of that suffering. But that's the key, is that person who came up with that idea for the house or whatever it is had to exacerbate his own suffering to be able to create that thing to make everyone else around him more comfortable. And I think that's the point of everything. If a person can learn to do that for themselves, that's alchemy. And it's got an echo effect. It echoes out from you and comes back in waves greater ever than you would have ever imagined them having been in the first place. But the main point is that that's part of that key, is that you have to do that thing without expecting anything in return. You have to build a house so that your society will become more comfortable and not expect it to come back. It's almost kind of a mind F that's how it works. But when you do it selflessly, that's when it comes back to you. If you're trying to do it to expect a return of some kind, you might get that return, but it's going to be temporary and it's going to be fleeting, you know?
Absolutely. You know, talk about freedom, right? It applies on all levels. It's like a hermetic truth, you know, it can't be forced. You know, if you try to force freedom, it's not freedom, right?
Right.
But you got me thinking also about synchronicity. And so something you mentioned just popped that into my head in front of whatever else I was thinking about asking you about. I know, because of things you've said, you're in the trades, glazier, I believe. Yeah. I've been a construction guy my whole life. And a lot of my best insights and realizations have been like working, like swinging the hammer. And I've thought about monks, you know, how they have to, like, you know, mop the floor or, you know, start the fire or collect the bamboo or whatever. And a lot about work and doing that provides this space where ideas can bloom and where synchronicities happen. So I'd like to hear a little bit from you about your experience with synchronicities.
Man, I can, first of all, synchronicities is what I base my entire work ethic on. I have done things before where I try to force a script, or they always say to be topical about your YouTube channel or whatever, and it's never worked for me. I kind of don't write the videos. I mean, I literally do write the videos, but I let them come to me in spurts of inspiration based on the synchronicities I see around me. I have never had it work for me where I'm like, okay, I'm gonna write this video, then this video, then this video. It always comes, it slips out of my hands, and then something falls into my lap that is won't leave me alone. The day I realized that was the video, my episode called Systems of Control. I had that one like on the back burner, but the video idea itself, like an egregore, it wouldn't leave me alone. It wouldn't let me sleep. It would wake me up if I tried to sleep. And it was like, you're gonna finish this video, and I don't care if you gotta sit at the computer for 14 hours, you need to put it out as soon as possible. And I was like, okay, I'll do that. So I was like, I meant to make a bunch of Zen videos, but it wouldn't let me. It made me do that particular video. And that's to this day one of my favorites. And I think the most effective video to help people realize the extent of their own freedom and what they are willing to put up with in the world around them. Of course, the example that I kicked it off with was the gas station people who have to pay for their own drive-offs, but that's, I guess you'd have to see the video or whatever, but it goes to show us that we will put up with a lot if an authority figure tells us that we have to, because it makes it seem like it's normal. It's something we have to de-normalize. But as far as I've had weird synchronicities, dude. The day that my biggest video went ape shit viral was the day that I got laid off from the shop that I was working at. I was building a wall downstairs in my daughter's room to help insulate it from the bathroom. And I was listening to YouTube per usual. And then my voice came on. I was like, why did my video just come up in the algorithm? And I looked at it and I realized that it exploded. And I was like, wow, you know, and then I got a call from my boss saying I was laid off. And I didn't connect that at the time, but that was interesting. But you know how the trades work. For anybody listening out there, because you get laid off from a shop, doesn't matter. You just go to the next shop. So I have a union card, so I can work wherever, you know, and bid my own work and stuff. So I went, you know, of course, went back to work. And for example, I was doing mirrors in this like rich person's house or whatever. And I did the mirrors to a T, the way textbook and all, as per usual. And those mirrors fell off the wall and broke on the ground after I left, after I completed the job. And there was nothing that could be found wrong that was done. But when I talked to a slightly more intuitive person, kind of a mentor of mine, she brought to my attention that the last thing that those mirrors saw was me dressed as a glazer, as a construction worker. And at the time, I had been having more and more videos going viral. That is one of many examples of these synchronicities that are not tiny anymore. They're shoving me out of the working world and quite literally making me write more essays and papers that become scripts, that become videos. And I can't avoid it anymore. The last time I took off work was meant to be a 2-week vacation to kind of get caught up with YouTube. And I have not been back ever since. And it's been 6 months. And every time I'm about to go back to work to get caught up on bills, something goes viral and it puts the money back where it needs to be. Never in any case where I'm making a lot of money, but always in a case where it just fills out whatever bill I have that I'm worried about, just enough for me to be like, okay, fine, I'll keep writing. And A lot of people will use the term coincidence hearing those stories. I haven't told you all the stories. I don't have time to tell all the stories, but it's no longer coincidences for me. I can't ignore it. It won't leave me alone. And in a way, it's kind of a burden, but in a good way. It's almost like a coach that won't let you quit no matter how tired you get and how burnt out you get. And I can't believe I'm one of the few YouTubers out there who, if I do get burnt out, I'll lay out on the couch and I'll just scroll through the YouTube comments, and it just lights a fire under my ass. It inspires me. Everyone is so absolutely kind. I cannot find any other channels like that.
For sure.
Visibility, right? If you read the comments on Y-Files, for example, one of my favorite channels, and I know a lot of people, he gets a lot of hate. It's one of my favorite channels. He's a debunker, but I like him. And his comments are heinous. Oh, they're out to get him. Why are you even watching? And I read my comments, and it fucking butters me up, dude. And I can't believe that I've been in a position to touch this many lives. I don't know. There's people, when someone comments that they quit doing heroin because they learned the art of sacrifice and alchemy, I'm getting up. I'm ready to write another one, dude, because that's amazing to me. You know, I can literally feel the authenticity pouring in through the individual comments, people all the time are like, I've never commented before, but you need to know this. And I eat that shit up, dude. It's fantastic.
Well, you have a good way of coming across super authentic and genuine, humble in your videos. Right. You know, your son pops in or the cat pops in and you're like, you know.
I like it to feel you know? Like you're in my house having coffee.
Yeah, it's sweet. You know, another thing I like is that you use like the universe. I tend to use that term too. When we say God, it gets kind of conflated with people that have been through religions, or people have ideas of what religions are that are often misconstrued anyway. But the universe is kind of like, sometimes I say the great all.
Yes. And
what I mean by that is that, you know, there is some intelligence. You know, what you were saying is making me think about like the Kybalion, you know, and there is no chance, you know, it's correspondence of things meeting up. In the world is a mirror within a mirror within a mirror, then that makes perfect sense. I had another quote of yours that I wanted to share just now, but here it is. You said, this can be seen as parallel to temporarily shutting off the ego and forgetting who we thought we were in order to pursue the deepest kind of love that exists. That Damn. Love being the unity with the primordial first cause that itself seems to be. Only love.
And I can't believe I wrote that. What?
Oh,
if you read that to me and said, guess who that was, I would have been like, well, I don't.
Like you said, it came through you, right? Like,
yeah.
Most of the time, things are discovered, you know, and where do these ideas come from, right? The great all.
I was having withdrawals at the time that I wrote that. A lot of people don't realize that. One of my biggest videos, The Dark Night of the Soul, I think it's called Resurrection While Alive. While filming, writing, filming, editing that video, I was having heavy withdrawals. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very painful. And that was my way of coping with that pain. And that's, I think, where the authenticity comes from, is that I'm not going to fake it and be like, oh, I've got to figure it out. And now I'm going to pass this on to you. Anyone who says that, I'm kind of sketchy of. But I am willing to say that I'm suffering terribly. You know, I'm still a recovering alcoholic, and there's a lot of things that just hurt my heart on a daily basis. And it's I have to not avoid it. And the best way to not avoid it is to film it and show it to everyone. And it seems to work for me, and it works for everyone else. I mean, it might not work for everybody, but that's kind of the point of individuation, is that if you're open about it and you do the work that hurts, it will, the repercussions will find you. That you mentioned correspondence, cause and effect is going to find you. I don't know what it is, the all, and I don't know who programmed it. I don't know why it works the way it does. All I see is that it is.
Well, we want that answer on the next video, Joe. Get on it, man. No, well, I noticed. Which, go ahead.
On the next video, it's going to be called Ringmakers, Custodians of Reality. And it was meant to be one of the more unhinged videos. Because I read Ringmakers of Saturn by Norman Berggren. And it was on the back burner for a long time. But then I found out his street cred and where he came from. I mentioned to you that a bit before. And as I went down that road, unexpectedly, oh my God, I think that there's these tubes that are spraying rings into place on the planet Saturn. And they photographed this happening. As crazy as that is, we can see that happening. As I went down that road, I started finding more and more speculative evidence that they might be a form of maintenance and reality might be a transmission sent here from Saturn. The way that we view biologically view reality is set into place against our DNA, which is meant for so much more. It seems as if Saturn, the electromagnetic power of Saturn, like a satellite dish, is transmitted through the moon onto Earth and into us in such a way that we are experiencing reality the way we are. It would be impossible to go into all of it right now, but I break it all down in the video. And that video was a journey on its own. It meant to be a 20-minute video about aliens, and it turned into a Custodians of Reality. And whatever is up there might be responsible for the way we experience reality for whatever reason that we are specifically not supposed to know. That's what drives me crazy. But
yeah, the things that are hidden and why are they hidden? Right. Why are these things? And like you were saying, reality is stranger than fiction over and over. We keep seeing this repeated, right?
Right.
Another thing that you said that struck off in me is you were talking about the process of alchemy. And I was thinking something I've kind of realized is, you know, they put alchemy in like a 7-step process.
Right.
We have 7 chakras.
Right.
And then also psychologists, when you go through something like you're describing, they have a 7-step process of dealing with death, for instance. You know what I mean? Right. And these all kind of symbolize this process we have to go through, this difficult process, whether it be to learn things or to build things.
Right.
To deal with the reality we're in, there seems to be some consistency to this suffering, frustrating part, hard work, you know.
That number 7 is one of those, one of many things that I didn't take seriously. I thought it was a kind of a superstitious, like magical, fun number. And not only the reoccurrence, but the implications of the number 7 are astounding. In the Bible, if you see the number 7, God's about to get involved. And that is wild. Pythagoras explains it, I think, the best. Is that the reason number 7 is the perfect number is because it's a triangle and a square together. So as you know, the triangle has always been, to our ancients and today, it's the first shape. Nothing exists until the triangle does first. Before the triangle, you just have a set of 2 lines. They don't do anything. They can't exist in reality, tangible. But the triangle does because it completes the shape. It's the simplest shape. So that automatically represents, because it's the closest to source, the dot that we have in tangible reality, it automatically represents, or quite literally is, divinity coming into our reality, which of course is the cube, the black cube, which is best represented in 2D by the square, which is 4. So that's 3 + 4 = 7. So that's why, I guess, in the Bible, when the number 7 comes up, you know that that triangle is about to enter the cube. And what a perfect shape. It's an arrow.
A house from a carpenter point of view. I always imagine the square with the triangle on top. And that's like how you draw a house. You
know? And that happens to be how every toddler draws a house, no matter what the house looks like. I don't think there's a coincidence there. The triangle and the square together. There's a reason that if you put a circle around all 3, that's the philosopher's stone. And it's almost one of those things that help you realize exactly how simple everything actually is. we like to complicate everything. That's what we do as humans. That's okay. I like details too. But when it comes down to it, the square, the circle, and the triangle is literally every part of what you need for the Philosopher's Stone, as long as you are able to apply the meaning of the three to yourself. And that's interesting, is that those three shapes are, they're three shapes. There's three of them, the simplest ones, you know. But it's in the Bible, when you see a three, you're talking about intervention. Whenever you see the number four, you're talking about physical, tangible reality, you know. And then they bring in the seven, and then miracles take place based on sevens, you know. The nine is always a duplication of the three throughout the Bible. It's not even really numerology. It's closer to that little game where the kids take the shape and they put it into the little block, it's closer to that than it is numerology. That's how simple it is. And then music, of course, is also those very shapes applied to sound. It applies to everything. As above, so below. Those shapes are the foundation of everything we have. If we were to open up this technology that we're talking through right now and break down the computer chips, you're going to find those shapes and put and organize in particular ways that make this possible. You know, the seven simple machines that we use on a daily basis in construction are variations of those shapes. So to say that it doesn't apply to psychologically to our lives would be ridiculous, because it applies to everything else.
Yeah, man. And those grinders with the sanding wheel with the battery on it, boy, that's a tool right there, man. We needed that 20 years ago.
Yeah.
No, that's beautiful. And, you know, it's really timely that you said things the way you did, because I've been doing on my End Evil podcast a series, like 10, 15 episodes on symbolism. Mm-hmm. And I've been talking a lot about the importance of studying symbols as a bridge for us to be able to look at bigger things. And I think it's one of the things we're lacking in modern culture, is the ability to, it's sort of a feminine aspect of our dual nature, the ability to not only be logical, but to be intuitive. And so I thought, you know, you're the perfect person to talk a little bit about the importance of symbology and why we need to study symbols.
That's perfect. I think the first example that comes to mind would be like the human anatomy. The body itself is so complex that it's difficult for anyone to understand without becoming a physician. Whereas symbols, as if you have like Manly P. Hall has a book called The Grand Symbol of the Mysteries, Essays on Occult Anatomy. And he goes into the ancient peoples. This is huge in Egypt. Whenever you see like a ram that's accompanied by, you know, those pillars coming down or whatever, a lot of the times those symbols are either the brain, or maybe they are the ovaries or whatever. But that's how they communicated without complex scientific jargon back in the day, was they used symbols like the ram and whatnot. And now when it comes to maybe less complex things, I recommend this for anybody, and don't let it fool you. So this is Carl Jung, and the book is called Dreams. Anybody would be fast to think that this is some kind of like woo-woo dream interpretation book. It is not. What he means by dreams is quite literally the psyche of mankind as a whole, the entire collected consciousness of mankind and how we see reality since the beginning. Number one, this book is so profusely illustrated from beginning to end that it makes it an absolute esoteric must have. Because Carl Jung has a tendency of being kind of so abstract that it's difficult to comprehend. But with the pictures, hence aka the symbols put forth here, he makes sense of your mind and how your mind works. He uses the word dreams, but it don't let it fool you. Like, you know, the Egyptians were the king of this. Every single thing in this picture right here has a deeper meaning to it that would be so complex on its own that we wouldn't be able to fit into our brain. But the Egyptians were, I think, the first of many to make things extremely simple, especially in such a way that it applies to you personally. If you read scientific jargon, it's cold because it doesn't apply to you. It's telling you what the objective world is doing around you. Whereas this is scientific as well, but it is open to your interpretation of what seems to be happening. The person who drew it, of course, has their own interpretation, but much like a System of a Down song, the lyrics of which don't have a specific meaning. It's whatever strikes you as it's meant to be. Now, like, there's of course the shepherding hook is meant to keep his thoughts gathered whenever they start to stray. He might be having vengeful thoughts or whatever, so he uses that shepherding hook to bring his thoughts back into his control, which is of course is not literally happening. It's a symbol. And then you've got his whip right here, which is his discipline to do so in the first place. Seems almost sado if you think about it literally, but as a symbol, he's able to whip himself using the sheer discipline of the self in order to keep his own thoughts shepherded.
Whip himself into shape.
Right, whip himself, exactly, right. And then the vulture is here, and it's gonna bring death eventually. So no matter how serious you take all of these things about keeping yourself in line, you're doing it for the greater good because you know it doesn't matter in the very end because eventually you'll be leaving this flesh and you'll be going elsewhere. And I mean, shit, I could go on with this book alone, but it's not just Egypt. Alchemical plates, for example, everything in this picture means something very specific. And not only specific, but is literally tuned to you. And by looking at these pictures and these symbols, you are reading a language that is not only literal, but helps the reader know what to do. One of my favorites, I use this all the time, it's a graceful swan. It's a white, beautiful, graceful swan. But this isn't in color, but there's blood everywhere. This swan doesn't have worms to feed its children. So it pecks away and eats its own flesh until it's bleeding. And then the streams of blood pour into the little swans, because it's going to feed the next generation anything it can to perpetuate it, even if it means killing itself, because this swan will not survive bleeding out like this. But by bleeding out like this, it'll give the baby swans the chance to grow strong enough to go out on their own and eventually bleed out themselves to help their next generation. I mean, I gotta let this cat
out. That's the sacrifice, right?
That's the sacrifice, right. And then, of course, mandalas. They're a way to capture everything as a within, so without. The universe and the consciousness are quite literally the same thing. Nothing captures that better than mandalas. I think I'm saying that wrong. Mandalas. I don't know.
I've always said mandala. Yeah, that's
right. Cool.
What's the conspiracy theory about they changed the timeline, the Mandela effect? Right?
That's what I'm trying not to mix it up with that.
Don't say that. Okay. If you gotta let the cat out, that's all good. I should know your cat's name by now.
Yeah, right. That's Paul right now. He's a tough cat.
Oh, you got a couple. Yeah.
He likes to go outside. This one is great because it's very simple. It shows the smoke coming from the sacrifice is a single thing until it reaches duality.
That's a very feminine looking image too, right?
Exactly. Right. And look what's coming from that femininity right there is a flower.
The flower of life.
Right. And then it unifies back before it goes up into the heavens or into the ether or whatever your favorite word for it is. It unifies into one thing up there. And as you can see his gesture right there, he can relax now that he's done the work, you know. But and then, of course, you got the classic, the Philosopher's Stone, which captures all of it in its most simplistic form.
The compass. Our friend Nate Kapp, he has a website called cubbyhole.com. And I did a week last week an interview with him. You would love his work because he takes apart all the Freemasonry and he'll get out the tracing board and explain, you know, each image in the tracing board. And each one has so much depth of meaning. There goes the cat. Yeah, each one has so much depth within it. And I've often wondered, you know, there's a story in the Bible about the Tower of Babel. And when our last conversation got me thinking about that, how in a lot of ways our modern language confounds our ability to communicate, you know, like pictures and images are, or metaphors and stories are a more powerful way to share information, but our minds have to be capable of doing that processing. And I think we've been dumbed down.
Yes. And those two examples are perfect because first of all, the square and the compass of the Mason symbols, if anyone not familiar or whatever, I know it's a very common symbol, right? But the square, we just talked about the triangle, the circle, and the square. And that's literally what's going on here, is the square represents physical reality and the compass represents the circle, which is spiritual realities, right? And then of course you put the two together and you get this triangle right here. The triangle is not evil. It's not an all-seeing eye. It's not evil. It's not some evil people have taken that symbol and used it for themselves. It doesn't make the symbol evil. It doesn't make the Freemasons evil. Freemasons are the most generous organization the earth has ever seen. Unfortunately, some people like to use their skills for their own agendas, making it therefore usurped into evil. But yeah, the idea of squaring the circle and those three shapes are, there's not a better simplistic symbol for it than that. And the Freemasons knew exactly what that was. At least the old school ones did. I know that nowadays, just about anybody can walk down the street and go join the Freemasons or whatever. I don't know how that happened, but everyone likes to brag about it. It's really annoying. And the second thing you talked about, the Tower of Babel, that goes right into what we are talking about how symbols can help explain the human anatomy, especially the subatomic things that we can't see. Therefore, we can't describe without the jargon in the first place. If you ask me, every picture I've seen of the Tower of Babel is a spiral, and it goes up into space, into the heavens, just like the cosmic serpent of the shamans talk about, the two serpents entwined that come up and they go right up into the sky. I think so, even before, I don't think before because shamans were first, but as architecture started to take hold, the Tower of Babel became a perfect symbol for our limitations of DNA. As you know, our DNA is a language. It's no more than a language. That's exactly what it is it's letters that create a code that makes our body know what to do with proteins to make more of us. You know, you eat food, it goes into your bloodstream. Those proteins have to be broken down because you need to add more to your pancreas or to your ball sack or whatever it is that needs atoms necessary to
information, keep, right?
Right.
Collecting information and data.
Information. It takes the proteins and it codes the proteins so that your body knows what to do. We still don't know how it works, but once upon a time, according to the yuga cycles, the DNA, all that junk DNA used to be on, you know, and we were telepathic and we had power over our immune system. I mean, all the stuff that Wim Hof does now and teaches, our DNA used to be popping. It used to be all 12 strands. I was on board, you know, the 46 and 2 chromosomes, you know. The Tower of Babel tells the story of people building this tower, and then the languages got mixed up, and this spiral had to stop. That, to me, is pinpointed almost perfectly. It could mean other things, like the Garden of Eden has a million. It's a template. The story is a template to apply to whatever you want. But the Tower of Babel seems to be the story of our DNA being shut off by some higher power somewhere, maybe Saturn, the way we talked about earlier. But something came in and was like, okay, maybe it's the yugas. Maybe it's the way we adapt to our Earth's electromagnetic field, so it's not on purpose. Or maybe there is a conscious entity somewhere in the universe somewhere that found humans who was like, that's getting too powerful and they're violent, let's shut it down. I like to think that it's the yugas, though, because it's typically Occam's razor. That seems to be, we use personification to describe things. So if the yuga cycles and reacting to the electromagnetic forces of the universe is what caused our DNA to shut off like it did, we would obviously tell stories about it using personification, like the Anunnaki or whatever other your favorites are. We would personify them to make a story out of it. Because if you don't have personification, you don't have a story. So we like to tell stories. That's how mythology started. It seems to be, most likely to me at least, that whenever our planet is closer to that electromagnetic field of power that comes from the black hole at the center of our galaxy, the higher our consciousness is. And we're getting closer now, ever since like 1902 was the end of the Kali Yuga. And you can tell if you look back at the Dark Ages, the World Wars, and before that to the pyramids. And you can see that wave of Atlantis would have been, of course, like the peak of this Yuga cycle, where of which the Dark Ages, of course, was the bottom, the Kali Yuga. And we're coming back up now. It's great. It's great news. There's a woman, the student of Yogananda, and she was on the show. Her name is Ashananda, and she was like this 86-year-old woman. And cutest little fucking woman I have seen in my life. Oh my God, I always wanted to eat her up. But she's a teacher in Silicon Valley, because she says that's who needs it the most. And she was the one who broke down the yuga cycles for me in that way. And what she's saying, I mean, really checks out. And it's almost soothing to know that we're on our way back up. Nothing can stop it. They're trying to. You look around today, you can see that they're trying to stop it. But our DNA is going to come back on, man.
I sure hope so. We're in desperate need of some positive change from my point of view. Yes. And when I look at, a lot of stuff you've talked about, even before I found your work, I'm seeing stuff about ancient pyramid builders, all these megalithic structures all over the planet. There's a lot of indications through, whether it's ancient shamans or master builders, right. They're telling us something. It seems like there's this message, and it really comes across to me like a warning. And I'm curious if you're feeling that same vibe. I mean, I think I've heard you say it in various ways, but I'm curious what you have to say about the warning to humanity that has been left for us.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is the pyramids, how they lay out the geometry and mathematics of the Earth, sun, moon relationship. It's all built into the pyramids, because if you take the circumference of the pyramids and times it by 432,000, and you've got the Earth and sun relationship. You take it from the bottom to the top peak times 432,000, and you've got the moon and Earth relationship, and so on and so forth. I think that there's a particular measurement that I forget the details on that shows the circumference of the Earth right there in the pyramids. They knew what they were talking about, and they built the pyramids on ley lines that are sacred ley lines that line up perfectly. If you take a straight line around the globe, as long as that line is straight, you'll connect all of the pyramids that we have. It's kind of cattywampus across it's not the equator, it doesn't go across in a straight line. That's not quite how things work. It goes sideways. But then it comes all the way around and meets again. You got Machu Picchu and the pyramids in Mexico and in Egypt and Bosnia. They're all on that line. So it seems like it was a global civilization. The warning thing, I don't know. I wouldn't doubt it if I saw data on that. But the way I kind of see it is that it's a preservation of knowledge, because it's stone, it's granite. In Easter Island, they use basalt. It's not to be confused. Someone's going to chime in and be like, they use volcanic tuff. Yeah, they did later, but but the original Moai were made out of basalt, very hard stones. And those are the ones with the glyphs on the back of them. There's a message there. And now Göbekli Tepe, that certainly is. Now that you might be referring to that, because Pillar 43, the Vulture Stone of Göbekli Tepe, certainly is a warning. I mean, you almost can't avoid that. It's a vulture holding a human head and pointing up to the stars with a little dot that says something came from there and it'll come back. Like, that certainly was a warning. And then you got the fact that all of Göbekli Tepe was intentionally buried to be preserved. Definitely that was a warning. But I mean, when it comes to some of these megaliths and stonework like the pyramids, I think it's almost a, they knew that these cataclysms happen on the surface. So before they went underground, they built these things so that we would find them and understand the circumference of the earth, much to the dismay of a lot of the flat earthers out there. That mathematics is put into place in the pyramids themselves long before we thought that we discovered the earth was round. Some people even think that that was Christopher Columbus, as bizarre as that is. I don't understand how that snuck into our education. It's absolutely ridiculous. Pythagoras was talking about the earth being round long before that, and then he said he got the idea from someone else, what he called the ancients, who are, that's lost to us. But what's fascinating about it is that the Egyptians wrote down everything. And one of the things that they wrote down that we forget to put in our history books is that they found the pyramids. We don't know who built the pyramids. We have no idea who built the pyramids, because no one even signed that shit. They didn't even put their initials on it anywhere. There's no hieroglyphs either. It's completely blank. It was sacred. And they say, we found these. We don't know who built them, but they were ancient even to us. If you think about pre-dynastic Egypt going back possibly well over 7 to 12,000 years ago, dates are debatable, but at least 7,000 years ago. And to think that the Egyptians themselves, pre-dynastic guys, were talking about, we found these and we don't know who built them. That's frightening. That's scary to me. And it, that to me, that points to Atlantis, to a time when, going back to the Yuga cycles, back when our DNA was popping and all and on all cylinders, you know?
Yeah, you definitely get the feeling that there were, at some point in ancient history, some people, some beings on this planet that had a much higher mastery of the elements of technology than we do at this current time. And just that in itself, you know, is sort of a message. And it's like, what were they telling us with this stuff? There's something there. And I guess for me, like, my whole journey of, you know, I make fun of myself now. I'm a conspiracy theorist. I've decided to just own it. You know,
you have to.
It's like my comedy bit right now. I'm Mr. Crazy Guy. That's fine. But what got me going and launched me, originally I was curious about like Bigfoot and, you know, all these mysterious things. And
that was my start as well, by the way.
Really?
That got me into all of this was Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And monster. Yeah.
And then aliens, right? And then you're like, okay, why is there so much of this stuff? You know, if it's all fake, why is there so much? Why is it everywhere? You know, and then that kind of brought me into this whole other recognition of things going on, deeper layers of the government. And, you know, at, for me, it really opened the doors to starting to wonder about reality itself and stuff.
Right.
So I thought I'd bring it back around. Bentov, some of my favorite of your work has been about the cosmic egg and Bentov. And so I was hoping to get on that topic a little, but I drank a whole cup of tea and I need to make a little bathroom break. Is that okay?
I can take over if we don't want to pause. I can go on for Bentov.
Go ahead and start talking to Bentov. I can hear you. I'll be right back.
Okay, that's great.
Awesome.
First of all, I'll say that the Bentov, the series of videos I did on Bentov has been some of my favorite and most well received of any of my videos. Because as you know, it took up 4 videos to cover all of Bentov's work, which is absolutely astounding. And the thing about Bentov is that he died early, a lot like John Mack, and the list goes on. Of men who died early seem to have the most poignant literature available. Now, a lot of people are familiar that, not John Mack, but Bentov, Itzhak Bentov, died in a plane crash shortly after he was done working for the CIA, spilling the beans on all this stuff to them. They wanted the secrets that Bentov had. They wanted his genius and expertise to be weaponized. And it didn't work. It might have worked, but we don't see evidence of it working. Maybe MK Ultra is them weaponizing it or whatever. That was fast, bro. But that was fucking quick. But Bentov died early, and there's conspiracy around it, of course. There always is. But it is fishy that he's got that wealth of information that he was employed by the CIA to uncover and to work on and to detail and to get fleshed out for the CIA. And then after they were done with him and he decided to share the same information with the public, he happened to die in a plane crash. I'm not saying anything's fishy, but some people might find that to be fishy. The same exact thing with John Mack, except he didn't work for the CIA. John Mack got big. He died getting hit by a drunk driver when walking home from, or walking to his hotel from a UFO conference. His family never prosecuted the drunk driver, and we never found out who the drunk driver was. Now that's weird. So he got hit by a car. They said it was a drunk driver, and the family's like, we ain't saying shit. To me, there is something going on there. But just like Bentov, if you want, as I said in the first video I did on him, I think it was my first line, if you want zero bullshit literature, read the work of men who died early. I mean, the same goes for men who died, but particularly men who died early, that's where you're going to find the juice. Terrence McKenna, John Mack, Itzhak Bentov. Oh my God, I'm going to kick myself later for forgetting somebody somewhere in that. But Bentov understood the reality. He understood the universe, the things that are so outside our conception and abstract to our psyche. He just understood it. He just got it. It was second nature to him. He was gifted, you know, and he used that understanding in his inventions. You know, he invented the hypodermic needle. That is how we put insulin and all that stuff. You know, he found things that were needed, and he used his know-how to help others. And then along the way, he was also like, by the way, the cosmic egg of mythology happens to be not an allegory. It's real. We live within an egg. There is no Big Bang. And the universe is constantly cycling in and within itself in a torus shape, just like everything else in the universe. Atoms, molecules, our electromagnetic field, plasma, I mean, an apple, you name it. If it's alive, it's got an it's got that torus shape involved in it somehow. So he explains that what we think is the Big Bang was the emerging from the center of that torus. And then matter, as we know it, goes around that egg shape and then back up into a great cosmic black hole. The black holes of which we're familiar with are just fractals of that. And that's when the universe, I guess, renews itself. It starts over. And they, in mythology, they called it the blood flood, which is amazing. That's a metal song waiting to happen, which I did. Yeah. The cosmic egg episode that we did ends with my song The Blood Flood. I had to make it. Some people commented like, why do you gotta be dark? And I was like, well, there's blood flood, you know, it's what it is.
Kind of calls for it, right?
You know? Calls. Yeah,
yeah.
But, I mean, and so yeah, there's no Big Bang, and it getting rid of the Big Bang opens the door to so many mysteries that couldn't be answered until you get rid of the Big Bang. There's so many things that are impossible to even answer or speculate on because the Big Bang hypothesis was in the way of us learning more about it. As soon as Itzhak Bentov was like, the ancients had it right. We live in a torus shape. They called it the cosmic egg. There's no Big Bang. It opens up everything from mythology to science to start actually making sense.
Yeah, that, you know, I think for me, what really struck is the, you know, consciousness and reality, how interconnected they are. And I like that concept of the torus shape. And then, like, I like to imagine, like, if you have this egg of reality that's sort of vibrating with energy, like electricity, right?
Right.
Alternating
right.
current, right? And then you were to take like a slice out of it. And that plane, that slice is the reality like we're living on. We're
right.
This physical reality where things are happening like linear one at a time isn't the great whole thing. This right. is just the experience that we're getting to be on right now. And I think, you know, that whole stuff about the subatomic physics and quantum physics, rather, you know, where we talk about reality and whether reality is what it is. Are we projecting? Is it being projected through us? I really love that conversation. And I'm curious yeah. to see kind of like where you're at on all that. When you're thinking about this.
I don't know if I would go as far as to call it an unpopular opinion, but because I still struggle with it. But if I had to end my life tomorrow, it was all over or whatever, and I was to put all my coins into one bet, I don't know. I feel like we project reality. I don't think that reality is objective whatsoever. I think we completely project reality. I don't think reality exists without us imagining it. And I know that sounds crazy because we can measure and weigh things, but the more you dig into it, dude, the more you find out the reason we can measure and weigh things is because we can imagine doing so. And I cannot find, as hard as I tried to debunk myself, that's my whole goal, is to find out that, okay, there is reality that can whatever. But it's like, the more you look at it, atoms don't exist and everything's made of atoms. Nothing exists. And I think it's a dream. And then after having Bentov and quantum physics run through that whole gambit, and you're like, okay, I think reality might be a dream. Well, look no further than Hindu mythology. And we find the Brahma, who is dreaming all of this. And whenever he closes his eyes, reality exists. But when he opens his eyes, reality ceases to exist. Because he's dreaming of us. And like, we live within the consciousness of a greater being. If you think about the closing and opening of the eye of the Brahma, that sounds just like that cycling egg torus shape that we're talking about, the cosmic egg. The more you break it down, it seems like we're all talking about the same thing over and over again in different ways. Every religion, every mythology, every scientific fact or hypothesis, every speculation, it seems to have its root in the same thing. And we're arguing over the best way to phrase it. That's what it seems like to me.
I want to come back around a little bit at some point, if we can, to objectivity. But I guess what I wanted to say on that is, you know, my show I do is called the End Evil Podcast. Mm-hmm. And I think that blows people away to some extent. They're like, you can't end evil. You know, there's always going to be evil. There's always going to be good, and there's always going to be evil. And in a way, I agree with that. You know, like the yin yang, you know, the different aspects of reality, there's always going to be light and dark, you know. But in the sense that we're humans and we're living in human bodies, mm-hmm. and I'm describing evil as forms of stealing from one another.
Right.
What I'm saying in my work, what I call great work, is we can be better. We can stop doing evil things, and then we'll be good. You know? And just like we can clean up a room, we can clean up our act as humanity, and that will open the door for a lot more happier, joyful lifestyles for everyone.
Right.
And so we do affect reality. And I guess the danger, I feel like, of saying reality is not objective is that people think, oh, well, then it doesn't matter. It's all just a dream or video game. I can do whatever I want. And there's no, you know, responsibility. And it's not really my, you know what I'm saying?
You'll be like carrying that with
fear,
you.
Over. So I'd like to see how you address that.
Well, first of all, the whole we live in a simulation thing, so I can do whatever I want thing. Whenever you take that headset off on the other side over there, you're going to answer to all that shit. So be ready for that, because it's going to be awful, you know? But as far as the evil versus good thing, that should not be confused with duality, with dark and light. Those are different things. Universal law, going against universal law is what evil is. technically speaking, there's no evil in the first place. We make it up because we steal from each other and we do harmful things to each other. That should not be confused with a lion eating a zebra. So like a lion eating a zebra is dark, but that is universal law. It's not evil. So you can end, evil can be ended. It can be done away with. We can go without it and still have duality, dark and light. It'll still be there. There's no separating that yin and yang. Evil is a different category because evil means to quite literally know better and to do things against the grain of the way the universe works for your own benefit. That can go away and we're still going to have blood and we're still going to have feces and we're still going to have nightmares and we're still going to have bankruptcy and we're still going to have all the dark elements of humanity and society and reality without the evil. And I'll be damned if, you know what, without the evil, all of those dark things become a little bit more bearable because at least now no one's out to get us.
Absolutely. And I know that you, in many ways in your own life, have transcended challenges. And like you could probably look back at a certain point in your life and said, oh, I could have gone that route. But right. No, I chose to read these books, hang out right. with those people and start putting my time and energy into this thing.
Right.
So I guess what it really comes down to is in every moment we have this, what I call responsibility to the universe
right.
to choose whether we're going to be part of the growth process or are we going to be part of the destruction process.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. And that's why let's not get so mad at the opposing political parties and the opposing whatever it is that is like on the other side of the fence, because they're necessary for you to have your own identity. In fact, if you were to get rid of those guys, you're gonna create a subdivision within your own community. You know, it's like people talk about we have to get rid of the left or we have to get rid of the right or whatever, and then everything's gonna be okay. They seem to be forgetting that if you have a room and you get rid of the left side of the room, guess what? Now your room has a new left side. And you just created a smaller compartment to exist in. You're fucking yourself, you know? You got to embrace the people on the other side of whatever. I don't have any political affiliations. Everybody knows that. It's a huge distraction. It doesn't make any sense. But people like to use it to keep busy and have entertainment. People love Donald Trump. Everybody who hates Donald Trump loves him. They love giving him all of their energy and all of their attention. And they retweet about him and they make long comments about him and they just love him more than any, they love him more than his fans do. And it's, you have to realize that they're feeding that. One of the biggest reasons that their worst nightmare got elected is because they made sure he did by bitching about him endlessly, making him the most popular person on earth. And they don't seem to realize that, you promote the things that you hate by giving it attention. And why don't you try giving your attention to the things that you love? And all of a sudden, you next thing you know, that those more of those things will occur to you. And it's super easy. It's super simple, you know?
I think each of us can observe that in our own process. Like when I've done it so many times, start obsessing about an argument or a problem in my head, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it becomes like the main issue in my life. And then a few weeks later, I look back and I'm like, why was I so wrapped up in that? That was just too much of bullshit. It doesn't even matter anymore.
Dude, it's crazy how much if you hate your boss and you come up with more reasons to hate him, he'll return the favor. But if you realize that your unfair boss, there's a reason that he's being unfair, and you see it from his perspective, as impossible as that is, you'll all of a sudden he'll return that favor. That's what everybody's doing, is just returning the favor. No matter what you're doing, if you're checking out at the gas station, the person you're in front of is just returning the favor, whatever energy you give back to them, you know. Except for people who buy scratchy lotteries, those people can go away.
I don't think Sean, whoever he is, you got to tell me the story of Sean.
Oh, geez. Well, Sean doesn't exist. There is no Sean.
Mythical character.
I had to create a person who just isn't getting it. And the name that fell into place happened to be Sean. because I saw a stand-up comedian. I like to go to comedy clubs and sit in the front row and get picked on. It's one of my favorite things to do, is to have a comedian just rip me a new ass. It's wonderful. It's like getting punched in the face. It really clears your head. And one of the comedians once upon a time was talking about names. He was like, you know, you gotta get you a good Dave. If you can find a good Dave, not a David, but a Dave, you can always trust a good Dave. And I'm like, looking at him, I'm like, damn. Now I know a couple of Davids who ain't no good, but every Dave I've ever met will help me move furniture. They're always good.
They got a truck.
Yeah.
Dave's got a truck.
Dave's got a truck, dude. He ain't gonna lie to you.
He's probably got a boot strap too.
Right. And then one of his little, he's like, have you ever met a Sean that you want to hang out with? And I was like, oh no. It depends on the spelling. So that's why I'm always careful to S-H-A-W-N, those Sean's. That's the one I use. That's my example.
Oh, so, no. I have a best friend, W-N, and he's a good Sean. So I'll just
let
you
know. He's a good
Sean? Not 100%. Right. He's a really good Sean.
I'm going to switch it to A-U-N then.
There you go.
I know is it can't be the S-E-A-N's, because those guys are solid. They're all good.
Cool, huh?
Yeah, they're cool. But, of course, that's being silly and talking about various names. You know, if you've ever met a Mandy, you know, she's going to give you an STD. Or if you have ever, I don't know, like if you date Vanessa, she's going to break your heart, you know. Or any guy whose name starts with a J, don't mess with him. He ain't no good. He's very selfish, okay? And I fall into that category. But it's just fun. But the name I happened to pick was Sean. And it stuck, and everybody loved it, and everybody likes to celebrate that. And even people comment whose name are Sean. They're like, hey, man, what did I do wrong? I love the show. And they get the joke, you know, the same way as I get it whenever someone says that they're going to go be creepy and have a Joe in the parking lot at some high school or whatever, and they mean Joe is a slang for masturbation. I get the joke, and you know, it's funny. That's why I changed my name to Joey, maybe. But
didn't want to be your average Joe, right?
All right. Well, there's so many Joes already. You got Rogan, you got Biden.
Oh, right.
There's already too many Joes.
For days.
Right, and then I think it was Nico. Well, I called her Nico. Her name was Nicoracle.
I've seen her in the Discord quite a bit.
Right. So she's like my main go-to for anything episodes, Library of the Untold. She's very knowledgeable, and she's helped me quite a bit. So I called her Nico accidentally, and that caught on. She got stuck with it. And then she called me Joey, and then that stuck. So that next thing you know, everyone's got a nickname, and oops.
Well, it's, I guess in a way, Sean represents that aspect of life that, you know, there's always a problem. There's always an issue. There's always something out there kind of haunting us, you know, and like you said, struggle is part of the process. And so I guess kind of the next thing I was going to ask you about, you know, to your take on this, like we find ourselves in this position with people, especially if you're like you or I, maybe earlier in our conspiratorial career, where we're trying to convince people or talk to people at the job site about, hey, did you hear about 9/11? You know, the tower just fell down, or these kind of things. And we get all this resistance, and people say like, oh, you're just being negative, right? I think it's really important for people to understand why we have to have a dark night of the soul, why we need to spend time looking at things that just seem negative on the outside and the darkness of this realm. Why is that so important?
Well, I think that first of all, I mean, there's many reasons. The simplest one is because you're happy all the time. You have no idea what happiness is. It's the same with splitting that room into two, the left side and the right side, and you want to get rid of the left side. Now you just got a smaller room. The same thing goes with happiness and sadness. Those two words are really huge umbrella cover-all terms for all kinds of different sufferings and anxieties or whatever, because depression and anxiety are different. But just as a broad scope of things, if you don't have suffering, there's no way for you to compare anything else to it. There was the guy on Idiot Abroad, the show with Ricky Gervais. And he was like, happiness is like cake. If you eat it every day, you're gonna get sick of it, you know? You'll get sick of being happy. And I have no idea, like, how much joy is in my life until I have an awful experience. If you have a dark night of the soul, for example, dark for those who don't know, dark night of the soul is an experience in your life that is so bad that it erases your concept of what reality is and who you think you are in the first place. Everything that you thought you were, you thought you had a personality, it's all out the window. For me, that was a divorce. Being married for 20 years and having the person I love most in the world literally leave and be like, I'm done with you forever. That erased my personality because I thought I was a person up until that point. Turns out I'm not. And I'm gonna hold on to that. It's important. Because now that I realize I'm not a person, and I realize that amount of suffering is possible in the first place, now, oh my God, I turn a knob in my kitchen and water comes out of it. What? You guys, how fucking lucky I, that is insane. That's amazing. It's raining outside and it's snowing, it's cold outside. But I got bed and a blanket and I got a heater. I can heat up my whole damn house for me and my whole damn family. And what, like that's incredible. I, how lucky in the scope of things are we to be in a time, the species in this time where we have water coming out of a faucet, it's poisoned, but it's great. It really comes in handy for washing yourself, okay? It sucks that we have to drink it, but whatever. We'll get over it, all right? That's, we don't have to bitch about everything. But we have toilets. What? Fucking amazing. All of a sudden, you go from bitching. You're like, oh, I'm lonely, or I'm heartbroken, or work is overwhelming, all this shit. And you realize that you have a toilet and you can just get rid of your own poop and pee immediately, like in one move. You're done with that. And you can go to the store. And when you go to the store, there's food on display for you to pick out and take home. What is that? Are you kidding? I don't have to chisel down a rock all day and then go into the wilderness and spend 2 weeks starving only to find an animal that will kill me back and then have to stab it in the damn throat over and over and over again while it's eating me back. And then I gotta drag it miles back to my family to be able to feed them. What an obnoxious amount.
You know, other animals probably trying to steal it from you on the way.
And then your victim, the saber-toothed cat's gonna fuck you up, dude. We can go to Kroger and all of that shit is on display waiting for us. And it's fresh and there's expiration dates on it. And now, okay, that's poison too. Whatever.
What cost, right?
right. But we take it home and we put it in the oven and we can eat. I am the luckiest son of a bitch in the universe that I've got these things. That's incredible to me. So the dark night of the soul is the catalyst that helps you realize that you are one lucky son of a bitch, because this is paradise by all means. They're trying to poison you along the way, but you'll have that, you know, undo it, microdose, psilocybin, whatever, eat your lion's mane. But again, lion's mane mushroom and reiki and cordyceps mushrooms are all available to you on the internet. You can order them. They will show up to your house in a mailbox delivered to you. You don't have to go forage and gather those things anymore. They'll give them to you. They'll hand them to you. And they'll say, here you go, sir. What? We are the luckiest fucking people. I can't believe how lucky it is. If I want to learn about a subject, about who built the moon, I can, as ridiculous as that is, I can order a book and I can sit in my warm house with a nice cold glass of poison tap water and I enjoy myself learning about the moon. And we're fucking lucky. Dark night, without the dark night of the soul, I would have never realized that shit. I'd be washing my hands and be like, oh, fucking grumpy. If I gotta brush my teeth before I go to work. You get to brush your teeth. Shut up. It's fucking amazing, you know? But no, don't get me wrong. I'll complain about a lot. I complain all the time. Have you seen my after chats after the episodes?
A little bit, yeah.
I don't know how it happened. Those turned into a fucking just bitch fest for me. Billy Carson and
everyone needs some time to let it out too. Yes. You know, it's like this dual nature of reality. You know, like if you want to do good, there's this other side of it where, like, you know, you got to put food in your mouth, you got to shit it back out too. You know, like the universe, the Taurus thing, it goes both ways. You know,
it's both ways.
You know, something's got to exit the black hole too, right?
Yeah, with the white hole, we got the black hole, the Taurus, and it's all one thing.
Kind of all comes together in a kit.
Yes, it's a kit, dude, and we're really lucky to have that kit. And that's what it takes. But also, so even besides all that, the suffering makes you stronger physiologically. I don't know if I said that word right.
Physiologically,
physiologically, whatever. Right, you become stronger when you do things that are hard. When your body does things that
working out, but breaking your muscles a little bit over and over, right?
Working out, lifting weights is breaking your muscles. Getting into cold water is, it makes your nervous system think you're going to die. So it starts creating red blood cells that you need. Doing things that are hard, the breathing exercises they take up time, whatever. And meditation takes up time. But doing these things that are hard psychologically give you strength. So it's not just a comparison to realize how good you got it. It's also that your entire nervous system responds to things that are hard. You get smarter whenever you force yourself to read that paragraph three times. You're just not getting it because you realize you zone out every time you read it. But you make yourself focus on this Carl Jung paragraph that's just not...
Do your eyebrows like this. Right?
Those things, for example, I don't know, not watching porn is a weird one specifically to bring up, but it's a fucking highway to happiness. And a lot of people are just so weirded out hearing that because porn has become so abundant and so readily available that now it's a normal everyday thing in people's lives, almost daily for some of these fucking fools. Not to say they're fools. I shouldn't say that. That's not good. That's the point. It's so abundant now that it's, instead of having to say, hey, porn might be bad for your dopamine system, now we have to say the opposite. We have to say, did you know that not watching porn is a highway fucking that drives you straight into happiness? Because, you can get into the neurological parts of it all day. Dr. Huberman is, I'm a fan of his. He's got a great beard and he speaks well. And by the way, heads up, it's good job with that thing. I like, you got the beard's popping, dude. But not watching porn makes you happy. And it's a shame that we got to say it, but it's true. But that's sacrifice now. That's the new sacrifice, is not indulging into things that are absolutely despicable. And I'm probably turning off so many people listening right now who are gonna not like those things that I'm saying.
It's probably worth it for the ones that you're turning on, because, you know, like Wim Hof breathing changed my life. And like you're saying, you part of the major thing about the Wim Hof breathing is the holding of the breath.
Yeah.
And it's like you're not doing something that your body needs to do.
Yes.
So that it can do what it needs to do better, which is a little bit opposite. But so many times, here's this dualistic nature of reality again. Sometimes you do use a certain small bit of poison to fight a bigger poison. You know what I mean?
You're absolutely right. And to be clear, I want to clear this up right off the bat before I hear about it in the comments or whatever. I'm a hypocrite. I'm riddled with hypocrisy. I've been poofing on this little thing our entire interview. This is not good for me. It's bad. This is the opposite of my book. This is pleasure now, and it will have a sacrifice later that I don't control. It's not good. But nicotine is a stimulant to your neurons, and by being addicted to this, I can be a little bit less addicted to opiates. And that's a sacrifice I'm willing to make as a little trade-off. If I was a little bit tougher, maybe I could just be free of all this shit, the caffeine and the nicotine and all that stuff. But I am addicted to a lot of these things. And if I don't want to be addicted to something that's going to ruin my life, maybe I'll accidentally pick up a couple other addictions that are just less bad. But yeah, that makes me a hypocrite, but I'm not denying that, you know. I've seen pornography before. I don't really understand how it became what it is now. Whenever I was a kid and I first discovered it, it was like tits and genitals and sex and stuff. And now it's turned into a lot of other things. So I don't know, but that goes to show you, you're desensitized to it now. And now it has to become worse and worse and worse to get to whatever point that you have to watch an amputee dressed as a clown getting hit in the testicles with a ball peen hammer to be able to fucking get off or whatever.
Like alcoholism, it starts out, I remember when I would go get a beer after work, and then pretty soon it's two beers, and then it's three, and then I can't even get a buzz without six.
Yep.
It's like, you know, there's so many things in life that lead us down those paths if we allow them to spiral out of control.
Yes.
So it requires this thing called self-discipline. And in self-discipline, there's this amazing alchemy that can happen where we can start going from, you know, being the negative person in the story to the hero of the story. And the way I see it, we're living in a world right now that's riddled with problems. We got corrupt governments, authoritarian rule everywhere, which is, you know, encouraging slavery across the globe.
Right.
All the most important mysteries are hidden still, even though every information's available now.
How weird is that?
Here we are sitting in the newest technology that the universe has to offer. It's like our bodies are like human body 5.0. It's the newest version of reality, you know, and we're sitting in this car, like you're saying, with all this opportunity and all this amazing thing. And what are we doing with it? What are we doing with our time?
Right.
And that's where I get kind of negative, you know? I think people need to do something more positive with their time. So I was going to kind of hope we could spend the last few minutes of our conversation, like maybe giving people some encouragement, hope, ideas, like we said, breathing, meditation, you know?
Right. That's perfect. And that's a perfect way to end this, because I would like to address certain things that I see all the time. Because people hit me up and they say, I want to do a thing. I want to do A or B or whatever. And I tell them the first step to do the thing that they want to do. And immediately they always say, well, I can't because I don't have this or that. And it baffles me. I don't know how I dodged that bullet, and I don't know what causes it in certain people, but people will for real put off doing anything because they don't have a particular thing. For example, a nephew of mine, he wants to make music. And so the moment he said he wanted to make music, I literally created like a bunch of beats for him, you know, and just gave them to him. And the next time I seen him, you know, I was like, so did you write anything or whatever? And he was like, no, I don't have a microphone. I don't have a computer. I don't have these things. So I didn't write anything. And I was like, do you hear yourself? You didn't write anything because you don't have a microphone. What are you going to record when you get that microphone if you didn't write anything? And some people, they want to start a podcast or they want to start a YouTube channel. The YouTube channel is a perfect example. And they say, well, I don't have a camera and I don't have this or that. I don't know, whatever it is. And I'm like, you have a phone and you can write on your phone. You can record yourself with your phone. One second. What's up?
After this, can we do something today? It's remember where we went last time for Pokemon Go?
Yes.
I want to go there again.
Let's talk about it after this.
Yeah, I was asking if we could do it after.
Yeah, after.
Yeah, we'll close up like 10 minutes or so.
It's all good. But, okay, so what everybody I think needs to know is to do something that they can do right now. And when they fill out that little sphere, the next thing will come to them. It's so simple and so easy. So if I want to start, I don't know, man, if I want to write and record a song, right? But I don't have the equipment to write the song. I don't have anything to record with or whatever. Do everything that you can right now with what you have. Let's say, for example, you have nothing. So what your first step is going to do is going to be to put on some of your favorite songs in the car and sing them while you're driving around and get your voice all exercised in every which way, whatever it might be. And then when you get some ideas, get a pen and paper and write down those ideas and completely max out. If you've got the shittiest guitar in the world, find a way to play that guitar and make it work somehow or another. As soon as you have filled out that entire bubble of what is possible for you to do with what you've got, which is nothing, something will enter your sphere that will make the next step possible. I don't know who does it. I don't know how it works, but it's exactly how it does work. It doesn't matter if you want to be a chef, start a podcast, be an artist. You're like, oh, I want to be an artist, but I don't have the good pencils and the good paper. I don't have the iPad with the Procreate software that I need to make these illustrations or whatever. Okay, cool. I'm glad you don't have all that shit. Go draw in the dirt like the Dogon people did. And when they explained their cosmology to anthropologists, use sticks. Use whatever you have, because the moment the universe recognizes that you have done 100% of what you're capable of doing with nothing, it will put into your lap the next piece of equipment or whatever it is. Guarantee you, the moment that you have filled that out, you're going to get somebody, a friend of yours that you're visiting or see at the shopping store or whatever, they're going to be like, dude, I got this old keyboard that it's been sitting gathering dust in my garage. I don't know what to do with it. Do you want it? You can have it. That has happened to me so many times because before I wrote a book, I got this like journal from Barnes & Noble. It's just a blank book. And I just started writing my favorite things in that book until it was completely filled out and completely filled. There was nothing else that I could write in there. All the pages were filled. And then the universe was like, okay, that you worked, you did what you could with nothing. Here's a book deal. And it happened anomalously. It happened that mysteriously. My first YouTube video, I filmed it with my cell phone. And I was, I didn't have a cell phone stand. So I took the phone and I propped it up on my computer desk, and I didn't have software to put pictures up on the screen while I was talking. So I angled the phone in such a way that it could see me and see the computer screen. So I would talk and then I would look at the diagram and I would look up the picture that I was talking about. And then I would talk to the screen again. It wasn't edited. It was just me. That video is called What is Reality? And it's my fucking cell phone propped up on something so I could get this out there the best that I could. I knew I wanted to do something, and I knew I wanted to talk about the mysteries, and I had no idea where it was going to go, and I didn't know what it was going to happen. I didn't know if it would be a YouTube channel. I didn't know if it'd be like a Facebook meme page. I didn't know anything. So I recorded myself with a cell phone, and then once I was done recording it, I put it on the internet. I put it on Facebook, I put it on YouTube, I put it on whatever I had at the time. And then I did it again. And then somebody gave me like a camera and some like a light. They're like, I don't know what to do with this. So I used that, and that became the Zimbabwe UFO incident video. I didn't have, at that time, I didn't have audio. And then, I mean, I did have audio, but I wasn't using it at that time. And then I got proper audio. And then I got Filmora, the software, because someone saw what I was doing. But that's the point. The thing I was doing with nothing caught someone's attention. Just one person who was enough to be like, dude, there's this software called Filmora, And it's really simple. Anyone can use it. It's drag and drop. And I was like, okay, I'll try that. They sent me their Filmora. And then I used Filmora to make a video called Hex of Saturn. And that one is going on 2 million views now. So it do what you want to do with absolutely nothing. And the moment you can't go any further with it, the universe will give you the next thing. But it just wants you to get up off your ass, and it wants you to start, or else we have no. That's alchemy.
That's the step they left out of that the secret manifestation videos. Was you got to get off your ass and start doing stuff.
That's what they left out.
Taking steps, man. You know, yes. Thinking about it and drawing it ain't gonna do it.
No, it ain't gonna do it, dude. You can sit there and daydream all day, and that's great. But you're gonna forget all the ideas you had because you didn't write them down. Or you didn't record them on anything. So that the secret thing is neat and it's fun, but it's riddled with problems because it gives people an excuse to be lazy. And and everyone's so disappointed that it didn't work. And they're like, well, you didn't believe enough. No, you didn't suffer enough. That's the bottom line.
You didn't suffer enough.
That's all it is.
That's a great slogan.
We're about to close this up 10 minutes ago, though.
My son is beckoning. I got to go.
Yeah, it's about that time.
Say other company names because that gives them money from people who are going to check out those companies and then they get money.
Hey, if Filmora is listening, give me a sponsorship.
Maybe they could send us a few bucks, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe if you do that, yeah, but don't just go out of nowhere and just say random companies.
Real quick, for example, a friend of mine who is
cool customer.
He's an alcoholic. A really bad alcoholic. I don't want to say his name, but he started painting pictures to kind of, he used to watch Bob Ross to calm down. And so he did it just to calm down. It was a way of coping with not drinking. Just that simple. He was like, if drinking is ruining my life, I need to do something to cope with it. So he got the cheapest paintbrushes ever from Walmart. And he started painting on paper. Not canvases, but on paper, right? So he painted a picture, and then someone saw it, and they were like, oh, dude, my grandpa's got a bunch of blank canvases that you can have. And then he started painting on those. And now, to this day, he's making money painting these scenes because he did something with nothing.
That's beautiful. Inspirational folks that are listening, check out Library of the Untold. Check out Joey's work, and do what your desire and inspiration in your heart is, and that takes some time to figure out. Sure. But I think we are here to do something, and I think that it does matter everything we do and don't do in this realm. And I encourage people to take that initiative and live a life that you become the hero of your own story. Why not? The opportunity's there, and there's so many problems out there. We got corruption on all levels, conspiracies as far as the eye can see. We need your help, folks. Everybody out there, you know, get involved in this process of life, and don't be just sitting in the passenger seat. Get in the driver's seat like Joey did and get some information and art out there in the world. Appreciate so much your time, Joey, and your son. Thanks for putting up with our long conversation, my man.
Yeah, I appreciate your time, dude.
I told you this.
Yeah, we'll be in touch. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Joey. So much.
Hello, this is Chris Jansen. Inspiration. Break free, it's taking over me.
species continuing loss of freedom is that humanity as a species remains completely ignorant of natural law.
The revolution won't be televised. The media will still be selling lies to get your eyes off the uprising and keep you ill-advised. They felonize the truth and prison those who leak it. Demonize who speak it and confuse those who seek it. Get deceived with all the psyops they propagate to try to co-opt the way the movement's heading. Yeah, learn how they operate. They lock the gates on those who can see the exit and try to warn the rest. That's the name of the game and it's plain that they're a test for the soul. On this quest, we enroll every lesson we grow and have an effect on the whole. That's what they keep occulting. The knowledge to keep the sheep of closing their pen as they creep and croak in nature, scheming, provoking. Keep an open eye to your side in the ear to the streets. Beware of the beast out to mark you if you dare to sleep. So I wear my peace with every outfit I've been made up my mind. If shit goes down, these motherfuckers will never take me alive. All right.
Visualize infinite individual eyes when they realize the way we make the spiritual rise.
Rise up, rise up, rise up.
Thank you.